Let's have a few questions for this morning. Here's a question. Dear Bhante, thank you for your instructions and stories. Can you say why you prefer Bhante to Ajahn? And first of all, let me say thank you for noticing. Yes, I do prefer Bhante to Ajahn, basically. The reason being because Bhante is a international style, and if you see the monks in Malaysia, where I spent quite a bit of time, and also in India, most of the monks in Sydney, where I live, tend to be going by the name of Bhante rather than Ajahn, because it's the actual Pali word, and it's used in the time of the Buddha and so on. So that's why I like it. Ajahn is, of course, a Thai word. And the problem is with Ajahn is that it's a Thai word which is kind of an adaptation of an Indian word, but it doesn't quite mean the same thing in Thai as it does the Indian word. It actually means teacher. But then it becomes used in ways that actually have nothing to do with the meaning of being a teacher as such. And also, the way that we use it in English is quite different from the way it's actually used in Thailand. And the way it's used in Thailand actually varies a lot from place to place as well. So one problem is that in Western circles, for some reason, there becomes this idea that after 10 years you become an Ajahn. I don't know if any of you have heard this kind of idea, but you have this idea that after, it's like a title, you get appointed as an Ajahn after 10 years, which is quite a distortion of the actual thing. You don't get titles in Buddhism. Well, you do, but you shouldn't. And calling someone an Ajahn or an Acharya is what you call someone who is actually your teacher. So if you have someone who's teaching you meditation or teaching you Pali or something like that, you call them, this is my Acharya, this is my teacher. But it's not like a title just used generally. In Thailand, the word Ajahn is often used just to mean teacher, but it's not used as such to refer to monks. If you refer to a monk in Thai, then you always have to use some other title like Pra Ajahn or Tan Ajahn or something like that. But the word Ajahn just by itself is not used as a title for bhikkhus in Thailand. So it's kind of neither, it's not really an authentic Thai usage, and it's not, the Thai usage is not the same as the Indian usage, and it's all a bit kind of messy. Anyway, so that's why I prefer Bhante. But still, Ajahn is all right. It's only a word. Okay, how can we sustain mindfulness in city life? You all know the answer to that. It's impossible. Isn't it? How many of you have ever gone into the city for a whole day and been mindful? Has anyone ever actually done that? No, it's impossible. Give up. Just give up. It's easier. They have this whole kind of thing, you know, the Buddha taught mindfulness in daily life and that kind of thing. That's rubbish. He never taught mindfulness in daily life. Anyway, what is daily life? What's daily life? Yeah? What other kind of life is there? Apart from the one that happens every day. Yeah? Daily life. What's daily life? I never know what daily life is. Problem is that when we're taught these teachings, we're taught like the essence of Buddha's teachings and mindfulness is everything, and mindfulness, mindfulness, mindfulness. You forget that actually the Buddha taught many different kinds of practices, many different things to do which are appropriate in many different circumstances. Now, when we come on retreat, we create a very special set of conditions, and within those conditions, we can train ourselves in quite specialized and much more refined ways. And I talked a bit about doing that in the first talk, and I talked about, you know, that we should take the time to really kind of train ourselves in that kind of moment-to-moment mindfulness, you know, just the, what is the the touch of things, what the movement of our limbs, yeah, that kind of very kind of specialized and precise mindfulness. But you can't do that outside of these kinds of specialized conditions, and you're not meant to. That's not what it's for. So when you're living outside of the retreat, don't try to take the practices and conditions that you've been having on retreat and just try to mindlessly apply them outside of the retreat. This is just shows nothing more than a lack of wisdom. In different conditions, we practice in different ways. If you're in a situation where you're talking with somebody, at that time, right mindfulness isn't the most important thing. At that time, right speech is the most important thing. Yeah? If you're at work and you're doing your job, at that time, right mindfulness is not the most important thing. Right livelihood is the most important thing. That's the factor of the path that you're studying. Yeah? If you're in all the different situations we have, there are different aspects of practice that need to be practiced at different times. And it's not appropriate to be practicing with that very kind of specific mindfulness or very refined attempt at mindfulness. It's not meant for ordinary life. It doesn't work. What the Buddha actually emphasized in that context, actually the way that we've used the language has changed somewhat from the way that it is in the Pali. We use the word mindfulness to translate the word sati. And we talk about mindfulness in daily life and so on. But actually in the suttas, sati is used quite broadly, but most specifically sati is used to mean the actual holding of your meditation object in mind. Yeah? So, for example, anapanasati, literally mindfulness of breathing, but translated very nicely by Venerable Tanisaro as keeping the breath in mind. That's what anapanasati really means, keeping the breath in mind. And that's the most characteristic way that the word sati is used in the early Buddhist scriptures. When the Buddha was talking about the more general sense of awareness that we call mindfulness in daily life, he didn't use the word sati so much. He more used the word sampajanya. And two are very closely related. But sampajanya has more of a broad meaning. It means something like a contextual awareness. They sometimes translate it as comprehension. So it means you know what's going on around you. It means you know what is the point of what I'm doing. Okay? And it's something which is quite distinct from mindfulness. I'll tell you how I learnt the difference between sati and sampajanya very quickly after my first retreat. And this retreat we were on was a month-long Mahasi Vipassana retreat, and we're meditating 14 hours a day, except at the end when they really cranked it up. And We weren't allowed to sleep for about 4 days, so we just kept on meditating. And then the retreat finished, and we come off retreat, and a day or two afterwards, the people in the monastery asked the meditators if we would help out with a little job they had. They just demolished a hut in one part of the monastery, and they needed some help moving the timbers and the bits of building materials to another place in the monastery. So, of course, we said, yes, we're happy to help. And we went out, and I remember very clearly, this was the first piece of work that I'd done after finishing my first retreat. And so we went there, and I remember I reminded myself, well, okay, this is my test. Be mindful, right? This is when it's going to see, has all that practice actually paid off? Am I actually going to be mindful? And so I remember standing on the side of the building site, lifting my foot up very mindfully, moving my foot over very mindfully, putting my foot down very mindfully onto a rusty nail which stuck right into my foot, very mindfully. So that was the end of that. I wasn't very useful for the rest of the building project. So that was mindfulness, yeah? I knew exactly where my foot was, yeah? Whoa, there it is, here, my foot. Perfectly mindful. Yeah? But no sampajanya, yeah. So no, that kind of that, it was no wisdom there. And I hadn't learned how to use that mindfulness in that very precise way, which is appropriate in meditation, but it's not appropriate if you're on a building site. Yeah? You need a different kind of mindfulness. And so there you need a more contextual awareness. You need to be checking, well, is there anything dangerous? I need safety and all of these kinds of things. So there's a very nice description in the commentaries about this idea of sampajanya, and it analyzes four kinds of sampajanya. If anybody's interested to look at it, it's found both in the Visuddhimagga and also in the commentary to the Samanyapala Sutta, which was translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi as the fruits of recluseship. And it goes on to quite a lot of detail and talks about this notion of sampajanya and how it can be applied, how there's this kind of awareness, what is suitable, what is the purpose of what I'm doing, what is the context of what I'm doing, and gives many examples given of how people would practice this. So just to come back to that is to come back to the question once more, how can we sustain mindfulness in city life? Okay, so first thing is don't try to sustain the same state of mindfulness that you have on retreat outside of the retreat. Right? It's not a matter of sustaining it, it's a matter of adapting it. It's a matter of understanding it and using your wisdom to know what's appropriate in different contexts. For example, when I was in Malaysia, I had one of the upasikas who was a very dedicated meditator, and you know, she used to go on these long retreats and so on. And then she was a school teacher, so when she came back from the retreat, you know, she'd go back to work at school and stuff, and she'd come and see me and say, you know, all these people are so annoying, they come and talk to me and stuff, I just want to be mindful, you know. How can I tell them to leave me alone? I said, well, you're at a school, you know, it's a community, you have to relate to people, you know, you have to become friends with them. You might know that you're just being mindful, but they don't perceive that. They perceive that you're being cold and aloof and you don't care about them. Yeah, so you have to learn there's a different way of behaving there, and you have to learn to adapt that. Okay, so here's another comment. It's been such an awesome retreat, which I agree, metta, but 9 days are too short. Can we make it a month? Okay, I will if you will. Maybe we can just stay, just sit in, see if they try to kick us out. Okay, so page 1 and page 2. Could you please elaborate on the topic of sensual desire, touch, taste, sound, sight, etc., when it comes up in meditation? If we as humans have biologically and evolutionary factors gearing us for survival, reproduction, culture, etc., how can we reconcile these pulls in the mind if we also have insight and belief in how this leads to suffering? And it says page 1. And here's page 2. Okay, I once heard of the Dalai Lama speak about dissolving and cutting off thoughts of a sexual nature as soon as they arise. Even he, despite all the lifetimes of celibacy, admitted to being subject to such pulls in the mind. Any reflections? Well, I don't know if you know the history of the Dalai Lamas, but I think it was the fourth Dalai Lama who was the bad one. And he wrote all these poetries saying, in his poetry he'd say stuff like, I'm sitting here recollecting all of the virtues and the joys of the Triple Gem, but all I can think about is you, my darling. So this is a question about the sensual desire, which of course is the first of the five hindrances. And basically, according to Buddhism, we live in what's called the karma loka, is the sense sphere realm. And we're born here because we want to experience pleasure through our senses. That's the driving motivation which has brought us to live in this kind of plane of existence. And that kind of drive is or has been incorporated in such a way as to be quite adaptive, and it's, as it's talking about here. So, for example, you know, food that we like to eat. You know, we like to eat fruit, for example. We don't like to eat rocks or something like that, which doesn't have any nutrition. So it's kind of adaptive. And also sexual desire, of course, is very adaptive. You know, we have that strong pull towards sexual pleasure, which obviously helps to continue the species and so on. So there's this kind of evolutionary aspect to it as well. We're evolved to want these kinds of pleasure and to experience them. So the nature of our experience is that our senses are always looking to try to experience pleasure and to try to escape from pain or suffering, escape from what is unpleasant. And you can see that this is happening to us all the time. And if you know, if you just walk along the street and you notice that your eyes are always drawn to something which is beautiful, so maybe it might be a beautiful person, or it might be a billboard or a shop or something that's very attractive, and your eyes are drawn towards that, and tends to avoid anything which is ugly. You avoid the kind of the rubbish, or you avoid something, disease and sickness and these kinds of things. So our minds are pulled towards what's pleasant and like pushed away or repelled from what's unpleasant. And so in a limited sense, and in a short-term way, then that has its kind of usefulness and it has its adaptive benefits. But also is very disturbing for the mind. And one of the lines the Buddha said, "Kame hi chitra madura manorama virupa rupehi matenti chittang." That sensual experiences are very sweet and very delightful, but when they change and alter, the mind becomes stressed. So this also we can see. Yeah? I remember once when I was a young monk and he was being visited in Thailand by his mother. We went travelling and mum took us to this ice cream parlour. And we had this ice cream sundae, you know, so for two monks in Thailand, this is about the height, this is about as good as it gets as far as the sensual pleasures go. And we had this ice cream sundae, and he just said to me, "I knew sensual pleasures were impermanent, but do they have to be this impermanent?" So of course that's the reality, isn't it? Yeah, that you kind of experience these things, and we spend so much effort to experience them. And of course, the more we try, the more we strive, the more effort we put into it, the less returns we get from it. And, you know, in economics they use the phrase the law of diminishing returns. Yeah, so the basic idea, you eat one piece of chocolate cake and it tastes delicious, the next piece of chocolate cake tastes half as delicious, and by the third one it's starting to be a bit nauseating, and then if you keep going, pretty soon you'll be throwing up. That's how it is, yeah? And so because of that, and because of that nature of this sensual gratification, then we're always kind of looking for more, always have to look for something new, have to look for something different. And as we grow up, it's actually a normal part of maturity. It's not just a religious thing or a spiritual thing at all. It's a normal part of growing up that we learn to regulate that, don't we? I mean, that's what we learn when we're kids. And our mum tells us, you know, if you eat more sweets, you're going to be sick. And you learn that. It's a basic part of it. And the failure to be able to do that is what leads, for example, to various kinds of addiction and so on, if you can't learn to regulate those things. So this actually is not... I mean, sometimes it's presented as if it's a kind of a special kind of religious or spiritual thing, but it's not. It's just about an ordinary part of psychological development. And one of the things that we learn is that if we can delay instant gratification, then we can actually experience greater happiness or a more deep form of happiness in the long term. And again, this being an ordinary part of growing up. So in the spiritual practice, because all of these, the pulls towards the senses are so strong, then we keep on bringing the mind back, keep on bringing the mind back, keep on bringing the mind back. And the more we begin to experience that pleasure inside ourselves, then the less we feel that need to be pulled out. But of course it doesn't stop. It's not an either or thing. It still happens. We still get pulled out towards the senses, but gradually it becomes less. The pull becomes less kind of strident, less immediate, and you become more content to just stay inside. But this is also why, another reason why, from the talk yesterday, why it's so important in meditation to be developing the happiness and the pleasure of meditation. Because the simple reality is that the mind is a pleasure-seeking device. It always wants to be happy and will always look for that. And if we can't find that pleasure and that happiness in meditation, we'll look for it elsewhere. It's a simple fact of psychology. So the more we can cultivate that internal pleasure, then we're content inside there and we won't be so desperately seeking external pleasures. It doesn't mean you don't have them. Yeah, you can still have them, but you in a way that's moderate, in a way that's appropriate, in a way that's mature, rather than being under the control of our desires. Okay, here, another 2-page 1. No, I think I've... Oh, it's over there, right. As a Westerner, I don't want to do blind rituals. Meditation and training the Eightfold Path is good, but I found bowing weird. I feel peer pressure to do it, but have ill will and resistance if I do. I don't think bowing is useful to me, so I don't want to bow or chant. Please advise. Oh well, if you don't want to bow or chant, don't bow or chant. That's fine. It's natural that you feel the kind of the peer pressure from people around you. Because that's, again, that's how the human mind works, isn't it? We work by imitation. We go along with what the group does, and we do what people around us do. So if everybody around us is doing something and we're not doing it, then we tend to feel a bit uncomfortable. So that's to be expected. There's nothing much we can do about that. But you just know that no requirement, there's nothing unwholesome. If you don't want to bow, don't bow. And people understand that people come from different places, have different kinds of cultural conditioning and so on. And so nobody's going to think worse of you or think you're bad or anything like that if you don't bow. Okay, so that's fine. One of the things that I've noticed is that, you know, since coming back to Australia, you know, it's a very different kind of way of relating to, in terms of respect, to what's normal and what's expected in Asian countries. And that was became really apparent to me once when I came back to Australia from Thailand and I was on a Qantas flight. And somebody said to the air steward, excuse me, sir. And the air steward turned around and said, did you just call me sir? And they said, yeah. And he said, oh, could you please do it again? So I thought to myself, oh, I'm home. You know, a couple of years ago, we have this thing usually every year where on Australia Day, the Prime Minister has meetings to meet the community leaders. And religious leaders and people from the different community organisations and so on. And a couple of years ago, Kevin Rudd did it, and he did meetings in various states. And Ajahn Brahm met him in Perth. And when Ajahn Brahm met him, Kevin said to Ajahn Brahm, "G'day, mate." And this kind of became a bit of a thing. And you know, when Buddhists heard about this, they were kind of outraged. You can't say to Ajahn Brahm, you can't say, g'day, mate. I mean, what's he doing? Anyway, I don't know whether the word got back to him or anything, but I also met him a couple of weeks later in Canberra, and when he met me, he was like... So I don't know whether his advisors had told him the appropriate way to greet a monk or anything, but anyway... Yes. Yeah. And that's the thing is, you know, in Australia, that's actually quite acceptable, you know, and but it can be kind of misunderstood. So, yeah, just participate for people who want to, just participate as they wish. We do have a very strong conditioning. I think one thing to notice is that when we're in a Western context, we tend to think, oh, well, you know, this is from the Asian or the Buddhist culture, the bowing is a cultural conditioning and so on, which I'm not used to. But the fact is that it's not merely the fact that we're not used to cultural conditioning, but we have a very strong cultural conditioning the other way. And within the Western tradition, especially from the time of the Old Testament, we have this very, very strong prohibition on worshipping idols and bowing and all of these kinds of things. It's not just an absence of the custom of bowing, but it's a strong cultural prohibition on bowing, which is, I think, deeply felt and has to be overcome. And you still find that very strongly, I find, with many Western people, often very uncomfortable visiting like a temple or a place of worship other than their own. And takes a lot to get over those inhibitions and to be comfortable with it. Whereas people from Asian background tend to not have that at all. You know, if an Asian Buddhist goes into a church or something like that, they feel fine. They don't feel uncomfortable because in Asian religions you don't have this same prohibition about worshipping false gods and other religions and all of these kinds of things. So people are actually much more comfortable about those kinds of things and much more understanding that it's just adopting a form which is suitable in that context rather than anything else. Okay. Could meditation help a person's cancer? Yes, it can. Whether it will or not is another matter. I'm just reading a book at the moment called Irreducible Mind, which is a new, very comprehensive, very thick, detailed study of the medical evidence for many kinds of phenomena, including ability to heal through psychological means. And there's a lot of evidence that practices like meditation and other purely mental practices can affect the body quite directly and can influence the course of diseases and illness in quite direct ways. One example, a fairly recent example, this was quoted by Jon Kabat-Zinn in his recent tour in Australia, was a study of psoriasis, a skin condition. And the cure to it is that you stand in a box of, I think, ultraviolet light, and that basically cures the skin condition. And it's a very effective cure. It basically is effective in 100% of cases. So what they did is they got these people doing this study, and half of them, they just got them to stand in the box and have ultraviolet light on them, and half of them, while they were doing that, they played them a guided meditation on how to be mindful while standing in a box of ultraviolet light. Okay? Now, they didn't give them anything else. They didn't tell them other meditations. They didn't tell them to practice this mindfulness. They didn't tell them to meditate outside of it or anything. They simply played the tape, which gave just like a guided mindfulness practice while they were there. At the end of the day, all of the patients were cured, but the ones who had the mindfulness tape were cured much faster. The treatment was much more effective, much more quickly. And so that was quite a strong result from that one study. And there are many other studies of a similar nature. But it's important to remember that meditation doesn't give you a kind of magical power to do anything whatsoever that you like over your body. The Buddha got old, he got sick and he died. Yeah? And meditation is not going to stop any of those things, unfortunately. It may help in certain cases and in certain kinds of ways, but the degree to which it helps, the way that it helps, why it will work in one case and not another, I think is still quite mysterious. I don't know of any really strong way of diagnosing or predicting whether it's going to be effective in one case and not in another. So meditation shouldn't be like a substitute for proper medical care or attention, but certainly can and in, I think, serious kinds of illness should always accompany it. What is very true is that in cases of serious illness like cancer, almost invariably, of course, is accompanied by a great deal of stress, anxiety, worry, depression, all of these kinds of things. And meditation will certainly help with those things. Not certainly, but almost always will help with those things. And if it helps with the physical symptoms as well, then that's also good. So if you're interested to look at these things in more detail, I do recommend this book. It's called Irreducible Mind. It's a heavy read, but it's got a lot of fascinating studies and information there. Okay. I'll leave this one till later. Okay, so is metta an emotion or a feeling? For meditation, we need to increase awareness and let go of emotions. Is that right? Not quite right, but metta itself is an emotion. Okay, if we're going to make that distinction, first of all, we have to know what it is that we mean. In Buddhism, when we use the word feeling, we usually use it to translate the Pali word vedana. And vedana is used in a much more limited, a much more specific way than the word feeling is used in English. So the word vedana in Buddhist analysis always means simply the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral tone of an experience. Okay, so vedana is very simple. It's either attractive, it's repulsive, or it's neutral. Okay, so nothing more complicated than that. All right. Now, what we call emotion is a much more complex phenomena. Much more nuanced, is much more variable, and so on. And of course, emotions are always accompanied by feelings. If you can think of it this way, emotions always have a feeling to them, but feelings don't always have an emotion to them. Okay, so you can feel a pleasant feeling or an unpleasant feeling without having any particular emotional response to that. Yeah. But the emotion will always have some kind of feeling with it. So the point is, we're not letting go of emotions in meditation. We're letting go of unskillful emotions. Okay, so we're letting go of greed, hatred, and delusion. Delusion is not really an emotion; that's a cognitive state. But greed and hatred are emotions. So we're letting go of our unskillful emotions, the harmful emotions, the ones which lead to suffering, the ones which lead to agitation of the mind and so on. And we're cultivating those positive emotions, the ones that lead to enhanced awareness, the ones that lead to unification of the mind. So it's important to understand this, again, because this again relates to the topic of the talk I was talking about last night, that this in Buddhism there's this almost this kind of fear of emotions, which is not very helpful. I was doing funeral a few weeks ago in Sydney, and you can see some of the people in the funeral are like, oh, we'll do. When our relative was dying, you know, should we hold their hand? Because if we hold their hand, then maybe they're going to get attached to us and they're not going to want to go away. Yeah, I say, don't be silly. Yeah, of course you should. But some people feel like that. The people who have more understanding of Dhamma would know, of course, you have to do the right thing, yeah, and give them that emotional support and closeness. But there's this kind of, I think there's quite a conflict within Buddhists, the way that we think, a conflict between this notion of letting go and this notion of feeling or emotion. And remember that through the metta practice, metta is not getting rid of emotions. Metta is mata yatha niyang putang. Just like the mother loves her only child, in the same way you love all beings. It's not about getting rid of your love or getting rid of your attachment. It's about expanding your love, expanding that sphere of your emotions to cover the whole world. So it's not just limited, but it becomes expansive and broad. That's the development of emotions. Okay, so question here is how to overcome fear. Fear of losing home, job, security and money. Well, that's easy. You just become a monk and you don't have home, job, security or money. It's very simple. No, fear is essentially an emotion which is orientated towards the future. Yeah, so we're always fearful of what will happen, what's going to happen. And the root cause of it is the unknown, the fact that we don't know what's going to happen in the future. Anything could happen at any time. And all of the work that we do can be just taken away from us at any time. We become very conscious of that through the news, for example. We see the earthquakes now in New Zealand. We see the uncertainty constantly. Yeah. Flooding, storms, bushfires. Yeah. And every time we see that, you know, you see so many people's lives just completely torn away from them. Their homes destroyed, families lost. And so we try to do what we can to prevent that. We try to make our lives stable. But it seems somehow that it's very paradoxical. The more we try to make everything stable, the more unstable everything becomes. And you know, even on a macro scale, you can see that as humanity's tried to make everything, our lives, more comfortable and so on, we're actually more making the climate unstable and making the very future on this planet the more unpredictable, the more we try to control it. Which reminds me, by the way, we should all be remember that by being on this retreat, we're doing our bit to stop global warming, because when you meditate, you emit far less CO2. Fact, all right? It's a fact, okay? If everybody meditated, a lot less oxygen used up and a lot less CO2 produced. So there, we're doing our little bit. So the essential way to overcome this notion of to overcome fear is through this contemplation of impermanence, the fact that we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what the future will bring. We don't know what's going to happen next week. We don't know what's going to happen the next minute. One time the Buddha asked the monks, who said, how do you contemplate death? And one monk said, well, Bhante, every year when the rains retreat finishes, I always contemplate when the rains retreat starts, I think to myself, I better practice really hard because this might be my last rains retreat and I might be dead before the rains retreat starts next year. And the Buddha said to him, you slacker. And another monk said, every time the fortnightly uposatha comes, I reflect I better practice diligently because I might be dead by the time the next fortnight comes around. And the Buddha said, you slacker. Another monk said, every time I go out for alms round into the village when I leave the monastery, I think to myself, I better be mindful, I better be diligent, because I might die while I'm on alms round. I won't make it back to the monastery. And the Buddha said, you slacker. Another monk said, whenever I'm eating my meal, I eat the first mouthful, I think I better be mindful, because I might be dead before I finish eating. The Buddha said, you slacker. One monk said, every time I breathe in, I think, I better be diligent, I better be careful, because I might not get to breathe out. And every time I breathe out, I think, I better be careful because I might not get to breathe in. The Buddha said, you slacker. No, no, he didn't. He said, the Buddha said, that's how you should be practicing. Eh? Every moment breathe in, every moment breathe out. Yeah? You realize that's actually all our life is. And so we're constantly sort of constructing for the future, building for the future and all these things, which of course we have to do. But we remember that actually the future is just an idea. The reality is what's happening in the present moment. And all that future will be is just another present moment. That's all. All the future is just a bunch of present moments. Yeah. So if we can't be peaceful in this present moment, why are we going to be peaceful in the future? If we're going to be worried about the future, if we're sitting here in the present moment now, worrying and afraid about the future, when we get to that future, we're just going to be worried, even more worried and afraid about what's happening in the future then. It never ends. Yeah, so there's only one way to overcome that fear, and it's not by getting a better insurance policy and making sure you buy a house on high ground so you'll be above when the ocean rises, you'll be safe, or any of these kinds of things. And it's not about ensuring that you have... eat the perfect diet and do all the right exercises and do everything, because you can't escape from impermanence like that. We're all going to get old, we're all going to get sick, we're all going to die. So we have to, instead of trying to run away from it, we just try to accept it. You just accept it. Every moment, it just is. And the future will take care of itself. It doesn't mean we don't plan or anything like that. It just means that when we're planning for the future, we know that it's just a plan, that's all. And we know the future isn't going to turn out as we expect. So if we reflect like this, it's a matter of, it's just continual reflection. Every time this comes up, you say, well, maybe not. Maybe it's not going to be like that. You're thinking, you know, I've got a meeting next week with my boss and he's going to criticize me because I didn't finish the project that I was supposed to be doing, blah, blah, blah. And then you think to yourself, well, maybe not. Maybe I'll have a heart attack before next week. And maybe my boss will have a heart attack. Maybe there'll be another financial crisis and the company will go bust. Maybe he'll actually be really pleased with the work that I've done on my project. You never know what will happen with these things. My father told me a story once. He used to work in WA for a company called Dalgetty's in the early 1970s. And they asked him to do this huge review. It was the first time that a company that size had done this comprehensive review of all their operations. And he spent a year working on all of this, putting all the data together, travelling around to the different country towns and so on, and made all of these recommendations and analysis and so on. And when he gave the project in, they realized that they'd actually, when they'd given him the information, that there'd been all these mistakes in it, particularly that they'd got the years wrong in a lot of the data that had been given to him. So all of his analysis was completely meaningless. And they just said, oh, well, sorry about that. And they just threw it in the bin and just went on as they had been before. These things happen all the time, no? What can you do? Another example from my sister. She used to work. My sister used to work in Jeff Gallop's office when he was the premier. And one time they were getting ready for the state election, And one of the cornerstones of the Labor Party's policy for that state election was a new health policy. And they kind of put it together, and they had a kind of thing. They were going to announce it in the press and so on and so forth. And it was this whole kind of secret thing. And when it was ready, it was compiled and so on. My sister pressed the wrong button on the auto send thing in the fax machine and sent it to the Liberal Party headquarters. But so that was the end of that. You know? So these things, you know, you think they're so terrible. Yeah, actually, oh well, what to do? So this is the thing with the fear and with understanding the future is just to reflect. It may not be like that. Actually, maybe it'll be much better. Maybe things will turn out better than I thought. That happens also. And there's nothing kind of momentous to it. Okay, so don't think that if I reflect in that way that's going to make all the fears go away, right? And if I'm not doing it right, if the fears don't go away, that means I'm not doing it right. That's not the kind of thing it is. It's just that if you reflect like that consistently, every time those fears come up, yeah, just remind yourself, oh, well, maybe it won't be like that. And if you do that consistently and repeatedly over a long period of time, then you'll find that those things just tend to not be so worrisome. You tend to hold them a little bit more lightly. And so the way things go, sometimes they turn out better than we think, sometimes worse. And when they turn out well, then you don't get too elated and caught up in it. When things turn out too badly, you don't get too depressed by it. But just have a little bit more equanimity. Okay, so that's questions I've got for now. It's nearly 9 o'clock, so no time for the guided meditation. So I'll go and get ready for the interviews and have a happy morning's meditating. Yeah. Uh-huh. I didn't quite understand the distinction you made just at the end with bare awareness and... Yeah. In the city, sorry. Yes. Right, yeah. Exactly, yes. Exactly, and so that's where that sampajanya comes, yeah? So, I mean, as far as the Buddha's mindfulness and the practice, you know, obviously if you're a very advanced yogi, if there's no hindrances, then obviously, yes, then you can be much more, you can be completely mindful all the time, yeah? Because the mind's not being scattered and so on. But still, even in that case, the mindfulness doesn't mean you know everything all the time, but it means you have that understanding of what's the appropriate way to apply your mindfulness in the different contexts. And that's something that actually comes out very strongly in the suttas, where you see how the Buddha handled himself in so many different contexts, that he always kind of understood, always knew the right thing to do in the different situations. So yes, if you know, for very advanced meditators can do things that for most of us only a distant dream, yeah? But we can still keep on trying. So my point about saying that, you know, you can't be mindful in the city, it's half a joke, but it's only half a joke. The real point is that if you're trying to practice mindfulness while walking down a city street in the same way that you try to practice mindfulness while you're on retreat, you're probably just going to end up being frustrated and possibly getting run over by a truck. So you have to learn what's the appropriate ways of doing it in different kinds of cases. But it's certainly true. I mean, people who advanced meditators can do lots of stuff. Yeah, just reading a case that was studied in India in the early 1970s, where they got a yogi, buried him in a pit, closed the pit off, made it airtight, and put all these EEG and stuff on him, these wires and things. And when they put him in there, they were testing, and he stayed in the pit for 9 days without moving, without any air. And they had all the EEG and stuff like that reading him. And for the first hour or something like that, he had various kind of readings on the machine. And after that, it just flatlined. And flatlined for 9 days. And the experimenters thought he died and that they wanted to dig him up. But his devotees said, no, he's fine, just leave him. And so about half an hour before they were due to dig him up again, his heart started again and the brain activity started. And then they dug him up and he was fine. Yeah. He was a bit cold, they said. He needed a rug for a couple of hours, but that was all. So, yeah, there's... and this is what the Buddha said, that the jhana visaya is unthinkable. Like the range or the potential of jhana, of deep meditation, is something we can't comprehend. Hmm.